This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. It's your boy, Michael Cruz Kane, your close personal friend and host of this very podcast, A Good Cry, your favorite podcast about being sad. Before I even get going this week, I want to thank all the people who rate, who review, who subscribe to, and who share this podcast. If you haven't done any of those things, I say pause this bad boy right now and go do them and then come right back. I promise I will wait for you. I won't say anything while you're gone. I'll hold my breath. Okay? Great. Good. Are you back? Fantastic. I also want to thank the people who emailed me at agoodcry@theradiopoint.com. agoodcry@theradiopoint.com is that email address again. I'm talking about Ballard. I'm talking about Madison. I'm talking about Miranda. I'm talking about everybody else whose names I can't remember off the top of my head. Thank you so much for reaching out. I try to respond to every email if I can, and I think that I have, but if you haven't gotten an email back from me, I promise that you will. Okay. Also, I want to thank everybody who came to my show at Union Hall. Appreciate you. I'll be doing it again soon. We're making it better every time, which I know you're like, how is that possible? The show's already perfect. We're pushing that extra inch. And when I say we're, I mean I am. Okay, grief stuff. This week, I'm thinking about a play that I did a monologue from in college, which, as many of you know, was just a few short months ago. I am now and have been for many years the age of 22 years old. And that play is called I Never Sang for My Father. And it's about a dude whose dad died when he's an adult. And he's had a very complicated relationship with his dad. And he's trying to work through it all. At the end of the play, he delivers this monologue that contains a sentence that I think about a lot and more every day, which is, death ends a life, but it does not end a relationship, which struggles on in the survivor's mind towards some resolution which it never finds. One more time. Death ends a life, but it does not end a relationship, which struggles on in the survivor's mind towards some resolution which it never finds. When I was in college doing that monologue, I used to think, this is the saddest sentence I've ever heard. This unresolved relationship that can't ever be resolved because of the death. But now, as an adult and someone who has lost somebody, there's part of me that thinks it's beautiful. You know, that constant seeking of that resolution gives me a sense of purpose. It's why I do my show, and it's why I do this podcast, and it's why you're listening to me. Today on the pod, we have my good friend, John Gabris. He has his own podcast called High and Mighty. He's got other podcasts. He is someone who, if you ever have a chance to hear him talk about anything, you should do it. He is so funny, and he's also brilliant. And what's really interesting about John, I think, is that he has this like tough guy Long Island exterior, but you hardly have to peel away anything to find a genius that's lurking like 1 millimeter below the surface. John and I talk about his dad, who died when he was younger, obviously, but we also talk about miscarriage, which is something that I hesitate to say I was excited to talk about, but I was. So many people who have listened to the podcast have emailed saying, I would really like it if you talked about miscarriage because it's a subject that never comes up. And we finally get a chance to do that today. John is just very articulate on the subject, very sensitive, and a beautiful dude. I hope you seek him out wherever you can. And I hope you enjoy this episode, episode 7 of A Good Cry. I hope it helps. Hello, Mr. Gabris. How are you?
Hi, MCK. I'm wonderful for now until we get into it.
until we dive deep.
How are you, sir?
I'm okay, thank you. I'm coming at you from behind my microphone. I wish the fans at home could see my setup here because my face is totally obscured by the microphone and I am in an actual closet.
I'm watching a very specific Shure microphone ad right now, which is an hour-long image of half the logo and a corner of your face.
Yeah, we dedicate this to one person at a time. This is it's a very slow rollout for Shure microphones.
Your setup is so weird that I'm trying to picture how you have it set up. I need you to text me a photo of your rig after this, of like looking at it from your perspective, because I can't even wrap my head around how this is set up right now.
There's a closet. I'm sitting with my shoulder against my closet, which is open. The microphone stand is in the closet. The computer is resting on a drawer that comes out from under the closet. I moved apartments recently and thought I would be in a place that was better for doing this. My old apartment, I was in a straight up, I was in the closet. I have now moved to adjacent to the closet. That's the upgrade that I got. I'm closet adjacent.
Closet adjacent, yeah. That's called growth. I used to be in the closet, now I'm closet adjacent.
No, I'm closet adjacent. That's right. That's a term people use. John, do you mind telling us in summary your relationship with grief? That's the open-ended question we kick it off with.
Oh, geez. I don't like when someone says grief, the only thing I think of is death of loved ones. Like I don't fully know the definition of the word outside of that, except for like Charlie Brown shit. But like grief, right? Grieving, grief. Like, you don't hear those words unless it's attached to the death of someone, usually.
I think that's mostly true. I think some people would argue, like, divorce or, you know, like, being diagnosed with a serious illness. But I think I would say, like, 99% of the time when people talk about it, they are talking about the sadness you feel when someone you know and love has died.
Yeah. I feel I have a weird, strong history. I don't even know what that means. Weird, strong history with grief. I guess what I can say is I have an interesting relationship with grief because of my weird silver lining attitude and also sort of my this is the kind of shit that happens attitude. And part of that is because death and disease was such a major part of my growing up because my family all died, like everyone in my family died young. Like I haven't had a living grandparent for 10 years. I have, you know, my mom, like, for example, when I got a new doctor in LA, when I signed, they were like, okay, you have any history of illness in your family? And we like, so what about your dad? I'm like, dead, brain cancer. Mom, twice breast cancer survivor. Grandma, grandpa on both sides, all dead before 70. And it's like, the doctor's going, oh, and it wasn't until I laid all that out. It's like, oh. And it's like, yes, my uncle has, both two uncles have throat cancer. This uncle, and like, I broke it down. And it was the doctor looking at me going, wow, that's heavy for a young person. And I was like, I moved here when I was 30. So this was 10 years ago. And I was like, putting it all in once like that. I was like, I think that's how I ended up being so okay. I can handle grief well. I'm very emotional. I'm very sensitive, but my brain works in the way of like, unfortunately, death is a major factor in life.
Yeah. So like your life experience, like your the algorithm in your brain is like the coping mechanism it's put together for you is pretty good, is what you're saying.
Yes, and also like I have that like dumb logic brain, which is arguably, being neuroatypical or some shit, where I go like, well, there's nothing I could do about this person being dead. Like nothing I feel will change that. So let me just remember them positively and live my life. Like, which is an insane, but that's like the break I kind of need to get it out of my head of like, well, what is being sad about this going to do for anyone? And I also have like that weird, like, I always say like, I don't think my dad would want me to be sad about him after dying. You know what I mean? Like, and I feel like that's a interesting way to honor him of like, you're right, Dad. I'm going to continue to live my life. That's what you would want, even if it is just in that generation that boomer blue collar attitude of like, nobody care about me when I'm gone. All right, move on, live your life, work overtime, raise your family. You know, that stupid like,
when I die, forget my name.
Yeah, forget my name. Like he was like, I just want a pine box, simple grave, like all that shit was like all he ever talked about.
Is that what you guys did? Pine box, simple grave.
No, mom's too Catholic to fully give him his wishes. And that's the my mom is intensely Catholic. But actually, She's like Long Island mom Catholic, where she's very Catholic, but also goes to a psychic. You know, like, not soup, not that Catholic.
I remember I had a lot of stuff like my aunt died when I was young. My brother had cancer. My dad had cancer. My grandfather died from, being a little older, but also having a brain cancer. I remember the first time I saw pine box coffin was when my grandfather at his funeral. And I remember being like, damn, we got a pine box. Like, we couldn't even like get a color on this or anything. We're just doing straight. This is the absolute no frills version of this.
Yeah. It's like a farmer's burial. It's like a, you know, like... We buried Paw out by the old oak tree. You know, we built the box ourselves.
Yeah, my grandfather, by the way, not a farmer. I do not come from the kind of stock that could do agriculture in any way.
My grandmother was raised on the last farm in Long Island, the last potato farm that was on Long Island.
That's your pilot, the last potato farm on Long Island.
Yeah. Yeah, when she got taken, like, my grandmother had, like, a third grade education. Like, it was like...
Yeah, but she's got that farm wisdom.
She had, like, five brothers that were all named some variation of the word I. It was, like, Buzz Eye, Wipe Eye, Big Eye. Like, they all, like, had these nicknames like that.
Like, their birth names?
I don't know. Because the thing is, my grandmother was a liar, and all of those people died before I was, like, 10. So it's, like, so complicated. We found out after my grandma died that her name wasn't Dolores, which is what she called herself. She was like, my name's Dolores. Everyone calls me Dee Dee. So we called her Grandma Dee Dee my whole life. And then it wasn't until after she died that we learned that her name was Lydia.
That's a big change, too. That's not a it's not like.
And her nickname used to be Lit with the Big Tit because my grandmother was busty as hell.
That's a big change for a name, too. Lydia to Dolores, it's not like. You know, my name is Lauren, but I go by Laura.
Call me Betsy instead of Beth now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
wait, so you were talking about when your dad died, the idea of, sounds like what you're saying is like you didn't really have a lot of time when you were like feeling the full weight of that grief. It sounds like logically you kind of were like, I can sort of power through this. Is that accurate?
And this might be a specific situation because my dad was in hospice for several months before he died, you know? So like that kind of helps you slowly prepare for it because like once you're in that situation, it's not like, well, fingers crossed he recovers, you know, like right. We were just like, let's make him as comfortable as he can for the next couple of months on his way out. So I think that helped. That helps. That makes it much easier. No, it makes it like, you know, you're forcing yourself to prepare for it in a way.
Right. You see it coming.
You see it coming. You can emotionally prepare for it. You're doing a lot of the post-death stuff while he's still alive, you know, like talking to him about good memories and stuff and remembering all these positive moments, even though he's not reacting, but you're having like these sort of one-sided sort of goodbye missives with him that do the work of once he's gone, what you would be talking about with your siblings and your loved ones. Like we felt like, you know, the funeral process started like 90 days early. And he was sick for a long time, sick for a couple of years. So like it was sort of an inevitability for so long. Like, for example, I'm able to say the doctor gave my dad a couple of months to live after his first tumor removal from his brain. And he's like, you know, my dad lived for like 18 months after that and then deteriorated again. So again, like I'm that silver lining guy. I could look back and be like, we had one more year than anyone thought we were going to have, than the doctors thought we were going to have. So like,
yeah,
that felt like a win because again, my logic brain goes, well, everyone dies, brain cancer, glioblastoma is no walk in the park, but we did get one more year than we should have. And like, let's look at that as a blessing. I understand a lot of people's dads are still alive and major parts of their lives. Great. But at least like one squeezing out a few more months at the end there, like, you know, anyone who's dealt with a death of a parent or a loved one would be like, I would give anything for six more months with them. You know what I mean? Like, so for that, like I'm able to look at that as a positive.
Yeah. Was that year very different? I mean, obviously he was ill or like, you know, sort of threatened by illness, but is the way that, because I know people in the past who have seen, who knew that or had the feeling that someone they love was about to die, right? Like you get a diagnosis that's like, you're headed into the last 6 months of your mom's life or whatever. those 6 months, they're like, okay, then we are packing this with memorable experiences to be like, you know, we're gonna live totally differently for these 6 months.
Yeah, the thing is, he was mentally deteriorating because of the brain cancer, so he wasn't fully himself. But when we got this like second lease, my family is like a beach family. My mom didn't fly until I was didn't fly in a plane my entire life until I was 22 with my mom.
Wow.
And we started flying to the Bahamas and all because my mom was afraid of flying her whole life. And after she had the breast cancer, after she survived breast and lymphomatic cancer, she said, well, I need to fly. I need to go. She had like a lease on life that she was alive again.
Yeah, she's like a carpe diem situation now.
Yeah, so she took like fear of flying classes, which are a real thing, and they take place. I love to talk about this because the class, and I think this is genius, the classes take place on a plane. In order to take your class, you have to go through security, you have to go to the gate, you have to board the plane, and then sit on the plane and people talk to you about how to not be afraid of flying. And
the plane's on the runway?
Yeah, you get on the plane.
I love that.
And then the graduating class, you fly from like JFK to LaGuardia.
That's incredible.
You like literally just take off and set down. You just literally, they just like take the whole class up and then down again. And I was like, I was so intrigued by that. It felt so like so much effort. And then you realize like, oh, if the airlines can get 8 people who aren't afraid to fly anymore, they can milk them for all their money like every other airline does. It's like, oh, I see it now. So then we start. And because my family is a beach family and a casino family, we just started flying to like Bahamas, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Aruba, Mexico. We just kept flying to all these like
every beach.
Yeah, every Thanksgiving, I would, you know, we'd be going to these, constantly doing shit like that. It was fucking thrilling. And then when my dad got like the second lease, we were like, we took my dad on like 2 more vacations like that.
So your mom getting sick was prior to your dad's first tumor?
Yeah, the way I kind of talk about it too is, cancer saved my parents' marriage because it was not a great marriage. And then my mom got really sick, and my dad had to take care of her for like several years and deal with that. And like, I guess going through something like that strengthens your marriage. And then my dad got sick and my mom flipped, and my mom, who's also a nurse. So that, you know, my dad gets the better end of the deal here. She flips and starts helping him. And so like my family, my mom and dad, who were constantly beefing my entire childhood and constantly fighting and arguing, once I hit like 23, which is when my mom was first diagnosed, from 23 until my dad died at like 31, my parents were like back to being, it was a totally non-romantic relationship, but it was beautiful that they cared so much about each other. No, just knowing like it felt like that duty of a partner to be like, well, they're dying, I gotta fucking step up here. And so that we had that ride from like, you know, 23 to 30. He died 2 months before my wedding, before I married Tiff. So like,
jeez.
It was a crazy couple of years in there, you know, and like I'm the oldest, but I don't live at home. Both of my younger brothers do live at home. My youngest brother was in college when this was all happening to my dad. Like, so he came home from college and, you know, being away for like came home from college and had like a month with my dad before he passed away. And like that fucked my brother up more than any. Like
having the month, you're saying fucked him up more?
I think just the timing of like, I graduated college. I moved my mom brought my dad to my brother's graduation in Buffalo, like flew him up there, wheelchair, everything. And my dad was like, so not with it.
Oh, gotcha.
And that was like, you know, my brother hadn't seen my dad in person in a couple of months at that point, cause he was finishing up his last semester at school, and then just sees my dad and is like, and then I think when he came home, it was like way too real that dad wasn't going to live that much longer.
Yeah, man, that can be some traumatizing shit, I'm sure.
Yeah, we're the older brothers, and we had sort of more time there. Like my mom didn't want to. My family is, you know, we're all substance abuse adjacent people, and we wanted my brother to graduate college. Like we were like, don't let him get like caught up in. And hindsight, who knows if that was right or wrong, but my mom was like, maybe we should have given, you know, my brother taken a semester off and gotten to hang out with my dad towards the end. But at the same time, don't know if he would have ever completed school at that point, you know? So like we had to make, and then the other crazy thing that people don't talk about with like parent death and grief. And that is all of a sudden you're in charge of like insane decisions that you've never like.
Crazy.
I'm 30 years old. I've made no important decisions in my life except like I signed with Paradigm instead of Abrams or whatever. That's like, that's the biggest thing I've done in my life. And then I'm having to be like, does your dad want this? Do you want to do this? What should we do about your dad's pension? And my mom is just like fully panicked. And I'm like, I don't even know. I'm a fucking city improviser. I'm a city-based comedian. I don't know fucking shit. I don't own.
I do improv.
The most expensive thing I own is my power book. Like I don't have, like I've never made a real purchase. I don't have good credit. Like it felt just crazy. Like you're just like thrown into this grown-up world. I've heard people say like in the quote unquote, you know, you become a man when blank. Some people say when you lose your virginity. Some people say when you have a kid. And I think your manhood begins when your father passes away because it just changes the dynamic in such a way. Like once, in my mind, again, this is super specific to me. Once my father had passed, it was like, oh shit, I guess I am the oldest man in my mind, in my family. Like, I'm now the alpha in my life. Like, there was only one person who was ahead of me, and it was my dad, and now he's gone. And I'm like, oh fuck, what does this mean for me now?
Yeah, man, is that heavy or what? Like, how do you feel about that? That's a pretty profound statement.
It was pretty heavy at the time, but now with hindsight too, like, It helped my growth. Like it helped me. I had some issues with my dad. My dad and I had some issues. We didn't fully see eye to eye on a lot of stuff. We didn't get along all the time. Loved him. He loved me. We talked all the time, but we're a little different. And I was a little over the oppressive parenting regime by the time I went away to college and then never came home again. So we had that, but once he was gone, like I at the same time as I was processing his death, I was like sort of arguably blossoming is like hyperbole, but I was like growing in a way where I like didn't have any shade over this patch of garden, like that I was like preventing me from fully being and maybe it's a combination of my dad being gone and him being sort of an oppressive figure in my life. And at the same time, me having like this sort of, oh, fuck, life is short. Like,
sure.
So I kind of was like, became myself even faster. Like that, like I always joke about like developing your personality in your 20s and 30s. And like the year my dad, my dad died and I got married in a 3 month span. I aged like 7 years maturity wise. Like there was like a dog year for me where I was like, 2011 was heavy as fuck, but I felt like a man. Like I felt like an adult for the first time, even though after I got married, I was like, all right, I got to go put on this costume and pretend wrestle in a basement underneath a grocery store. Like, I still had to go do that, but I felt more like a grown-up. And then also, that grief is something you carry with you when people are talking to you and, like, people are like, oh, like, my brain goes to, like, people will be like, oh, it's so annoying, this, that, the other thing. I'll be like, yeah, but it's not as bad as your dad dying. It's, like, where my brain was always at. Like,
yeah,
so he
sure.
kind of, that also kind of recalibrated life in a way where it's like none of this small shit matters. Like if you're fucked, and like briefly after my dad died, I had no patience for people being upset about their grandparents dying. Like you know, like people might like I like lot they're like my grandmother is dying. I'm like, that's what grandparents do, you fuck. Like I just like couldn't like
they're supposed to.
There's everyone dies. They're the oldest people in your lives. That's if they die first, that's good.
Yeah, they're first in line to die. Ahead of you.
Yeah, they're ahead of you. Ideally, you do see your grandparents die. If you don't, that's sadder.
It's very sad for somebody else. Yeah.
Yeah, for someone, probably the person in the middle there.
did you got married right after your dad died? Did the specter of your dad, did his death hang over your wedding in some way?
In a bit of a way, not in like a bad way, in a really positive way. Like we had a moment for him and during the ceremony, like we were got married in a barn, and during the ceremony, the doors like blew open. And this was like the first big family event after my dad died. And my dad's whole side of the family is obviously at the wedding, and everyone's blasted, which is their They're like that regardless of the wedding or death. Right.
Happened to be a wedding, but
yeah, they're the substance abuse adjacent genetics that we've all got. They're like, oh shit, it's your dad, it's dad. Oh my god, you know. And it was just here's a very heavy / funny moment. The biggest, heaviest moment for me of missing my dad at my wedding was my two younger brothers, who are my best men, walking my mom down the aisle, and my mom is like, this is something I'm sure she imagined her whole life of her and her husband seeing her kids get married.
Yeah.
And you just see it on her face. My mom, as previously mentioned, is an Italian Catholic. So she's a touch on the dramatic side. You know, she's like weeping, like, you know, as my brothers like hold her up as she walks down the aisle. But also a group of our family, like my wife's side of the family, came down from Westchester, and her dad, who's a bit of a, was, who also recently passed away, but was a bit of a party animal, rented a bus and took everyone from the Westchester family down on the bus. And they were partying on the bus, including like my wife's neighbor, who is like a 19-year-old girl at this point. She parties with everybody. She's invited to the wedding because she's a big part of the family or whatever. Uh-huh. She's blasted. She falls out of her chair during the ceremony, and she's got on like a very, I'm a 19-year-old girl outfit. Like she looked amazing. I was, she falls down and her legs go like wide open. Her underwear is visible to only to the people who are up on the dais, which is me, Tiffany, and our officiant.
Yeah, yeah, the VIPs.
The VIPs. When you look down so then I'm looking down the aisle. There's a 19-year-old near stranger to me, spread eagle with her underwear visible, high heels up in the air, rolling around like a fucking turtle. And behind that image are my two brothers holding up my mom, who's hysterical crying and can't even register what's happening in front of her. But like my brother, I like lock eyes with my brothers, who have amazing senses of humor and are also gallows-y humor like myself. And they look at me and they're like, what the fuck do we do? It's like they kind of just slowed down walking as someone else went and got her and like put her back in her chair.
They just kick her off to the side.
Yeah, exactly. It's like just stepping over her with my mom in her fucking wedding gown.
Let me say on your mom's behalf, I get the crying walking down. I cry walking down the aisle. I mean, like at a wedding, the parents coming down the aisle, and also when the bride comes down, I'm going to get teary-eyed pretty much every time that happens.
I'm a pretty raw nerve when it comes to crying. I'm pretty emotionally close to weeping. In the right situations, both out of happiness and out of sadness. And also, I think being a bit of a stoner, like, because when I'm high, it is easier to laugh and it is easier to cry once you're stoned, I feel like.
Yeah.
So I frequently at weddings, I'm like weeping during speeches. I just went to like a wedding where everyone was charming and like was one of those weddings where it's like, oh, the bride and groom have good relationships with their parents, aunts, uncles. Like there was like six speeches. Every one of them was like different and touching. And me and my wife were just in the crowd, like hysterical crying, being like, could you imagine asking one of our moms to give a speech like this? Like they're so like, my mom is so self-centered. I could not imagine her giving these like beautiful. They were like, and Emily has always been a wonderful artist since painting the coffee, like all these things. And it's like, my parents, like my mom wouldn't even be able to like explain what I do. She'd be like, he does this little podcast in California and he make, and that's good. And Guy Code, like, you know, she'd like, my mom is no, it felt so, I'm a big crier at weddings. I'm a big crier at movies. I'm a big crier at content. You know what I mean? Like speeches, like, it always gets me.
What is a good, we're ranging all over the place subject wise here, but I'm so into it. What is a good cry for you? What's like the last thing? What's the last thing you cried at? Or what is like a reliable cry?
Ooh, a reliable cry is someone in a film having to make a decision that they know is going to hurt someone they love, but they like there's no choice. Like they have to make like the let go of Jack so you can survive kind of moment. Like
sure, sure.
Things like that get me. I used to really be, I used to watch Modern Family. It was like one of those shows that I would DVR all the episodes and then like after my wife fell asleep, be like, oh, I'm going to rip the bong and watch three Modern Families or whatever. I would cry at the third act in that show frequently.
Oh yeah, they get you.
They're doing fucking heavy treacle shit where it's like, Phil and Luke are like having a catch and it's like, dad, I'm sorry. I'm just like, oh! Like they knew how to get you to be a little touched by the end of their episodes.
Did you ever watch, this is not a comedy show, but did you ever watch Parenthood, the TV show Parenthood?
No, I didn't. That would wreck me.
Oh my God. It's absolute orgasms of crying. Like you just cry start to finish. It's straight treacle directly to the dome. It'll break you.
I'm trying to remember what I was recently weeping during, and Tiffany was like, are you crying? I was like, hell yeah. She's like, me too. And I forget what it was. It was something recent that we were watching. Because frequently I'm crying and she's not.
Yeah.
You know, but now she's also a bit of a stoner. So we both end up crying together sometimes.
I used to cry in any movie or TV show where a dad did anything would make me cry. And my dad was alive, remains alive to this day.
Does it hit you harder as a dad too now? Like now that you are a dad, does that?
Honestly, it doesn't. I think because like I used to have when I was a kid, this very romantic, like godlike vision of what fatherhood was. And now as a dad, I know what like stumble bum bullshit I do every day. I'm like, there's no glory in this at all. I'll still cry at stuff, but I'm saying it's much harder. Like now when I see a movie and something like, you know, maudlin happens with a dad, I'm like, oh, that's just bullshit. Like that's bullshit. That's not a real thing. Whereas anytime, like a dad would literally walk through the background of some TV show and I'd be like, that's somebody's dad. You know what I mean? I'm on the edge.
I always have a hard time when I get choked up when like parents are like wildly supportive. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you watch these like movies where a child has to make like a big decision in life and like parents are just super supportive of.
Sure.
Like that's not something I experienced growing up. So like that shit hits me in a way. Like, I guess, is it jealous crying that I'm doing at that point? It's like one part grief, one part jealousy where I'm like, why couldn't my parents care?
Fuck you, kid. Yeah. Yeah, my version of that is whenever kids are really good at something, I cry. Like School of Rock, anytime when any one of those individual kids starts playing their instrument, and you're like, oh my God, that one's good too. She can really play the xylophone or whatever.
School of Rock gets me, dude. I get what you're saying. It's like a kid who's just fully, I just texted my wife during this conversation to remember. Love on the Spectrum is the show that made.
What is that?
It's a show on Netflix about people on the autism spectrum, neurodivergent people dating.
It's like a reality show?
It's like a reality show, but it's treated way better than it's not exploitative at all. Like it's all experts. It's all, but it's really, really enjoyable to watch because they're, and I think I've talked about this before and I apologize if I'm speaking like incorrectly about neuroatypical people, but the way that they frequently are very truthful and straightforward and direct appeals to me in a very great way. And it makes for very good programming where people are like, I'm sorry, but I do not feel comfortable dating you any further. And they get up and walk away. Like, it's so real. And the characters are really, the people they follow are very heartfelt and funny. It's a wonderful show. I highly recommend you check it out.
Wow. Big plug for Love on the Spectrum. That sounds great.
Hell yeah.
It does seem like the tendency maybe, and again, I don't know how to talk about this properly, so I apologize in advance, but the tendency, at least as I think of it, of some neurodivergent people to cut to the truth directly does also make me very emotional. When you're like, that person just said the actual thing they are thinking, which never happens in real life, devastating.
Honestly, Mike, I didn't even think of that. That's definitely part of it. Because I will say, this is not grief adjacent, but one of the most touching, one of my most favorite things in the world is when adults talk to children like they're adults.
Yeah.
Which is something I stole from just seeing. And like with my nephews, I'd be like, Justin Jr., how was soccer practice? And like, I'm talking like I would talk to you. And whether or not he's even picking up on all of it, I'm just having like, I refuse to be like, so tell me how soccer, like, I'm just like, no. And I don't know if this is right or wrong, but it's so beautiful when you see it, when like, and I guess you're talking about kids being really good at things gets you emotional. Kids being like preternaturally mature also get me very emotional. Like, you know, where they're like, that's okay, dad. It's okay to be sad or some shit. I'll be like,
oh, yeah. Oh my God. Even you saying that is making me sad in a good, but the good kind.
Yeah.
But I've had that before from my kids saying to me like, you know, Yeah. When your kids comfort you as a parent, or even like, you know, nieces and nephews, there's definitely a lot of emotion packed into that. I wanted to go back to one thing you mentioned a while ago, which is how your parents showed up for each other when they got sick.
Yeah.
Like that's something like for me and my wife, you know, our marriage, I love my wife intensely. We are, you know, are very much in love. And I think one thing that has come out of losing our son is, you know, we have arguments like anybody else, but I do feel like we are forged together in a way that we might not have been.
Yeah.
You know, not that we would have loved each other any more or less, but it's like being in, it's definitely not like this, but I think of it as like being in a trench with somebody.
It's emotionally Vietnam. You know what I mean? Like you went through something with your wife that not everyone can understand. And you were the two that were in bed together every night, or you were the two that were there dealing with each other's emotions. And that's heavy, because that's not even like, there's so many, I'm like, oh, Gamers is an interesting, smart guy. He says losing your child is heavy. But like, it's also even not one-sided, which a lot of grief is kind of like, my husband's father is dying and it's very heavy on him. I'm here to support him.
Right.
This is a moment where both of you are like raw and dealing with it and supporting each other, which is an intense place to be. And like, I could totally see how that would, and at minimum, and this, forgive me if this comes across as crass, at minimum, something major like that happening reorganizes your priorities, where you're like, it's probably like you're going to be less likely to be upset with something from your partner once you've like been like, once your world has been thrown up like that. It's like, well, then who gives a fuck if she leaves my toothbrush on? Like, you know what I mean? Like that like shit doesn't matter anymore. Like we've been through the fucking crucible of fire. And it's like, I'm not going to sit here and be like, so you're not coming to my Diamond Lion show tonight? You know what I mean? Like you can't, like that's your whole dynamic change. And obviously there, I'm doing it on the most basic fucking level, changes your relationship, interpersonal and outer personal. But and that's something that my dad dying did for me in a positive way, was just like reorganize, like that's actually what sucks about life. Not getting a call back, or not, you know, doing this dumb thing. It like reminds you of what real life is in a terrible, terrible, there's got to be a better way to be reminded, but it is.
But it definitely pulls things into a different perspective. You have a bird's eye view that you didn't have before. But I will say that reorganization, like the profundity of it, I think is a little bit temporary. In other words, mm-hmm. I'll post about a show on Instagram and be like, hey, to my wife, like, I notice you didn't share my, you know what I mean? I'm still able to get mad about some complete bullshit. I don't want anyone to think that this happened to me and I became a better person.
Magnanimous or something. Yeah. But also that's a sign of growth too, that like, you know, like you went through this terrible thing together, but you're still a normal married couple. You know, you're still like, can you put your feet on the table instead of on my lap, please? Like, you know, like you can still have like the classic marriage beef conversations of like, no, you pick the dinner three nights in a row. It's my turn. You know, like some shit like that.
Yeah. I guess like what it means now is that we are like, you know, we have all the, like whatever misgivings we had before, those remain. I mean, we work on them, whatever, but it's also like we're three-legged race the rest of the way.
Yeah. You're bonded by, and also like once you've done that together, like, my wife, luckily, because I've been with Tiffany for so long, my wife was there for me when my dad died, and that was super important. And then, weirdly enough, a few years later, once we were moved out here, her dad died. And her dad and my dad were very similar in that they were like blue-collar, tough guys. And she has two younger brothers who are the same ages as my two younger brothers. And it felt like weirdly like destiny that I was with Tiffany when her dad died, because I had just literally done all of this.
Right.
Like 8 years earlier, I had done everything that we were like all this 4 years earlier, I think actually was the difference in our, and now I'm the outsider. I'm the oldest man in their family now. And I'm a son-in-law. So I'm like married to the family. And now I'm going like, talking to my two brothers-in-law who are way younger, and I'm talking to them and I'm like, look, today a lot of people are going to come up to you and talk to you about how sad they are and about how affected they are by this death. They're going to say, keep talking about how great of a man he was, blah, blah, blah. And never once ask you how you're doing or give a fuck that you're they're dumping their grief on top of you on the day of your dad's death. Like, do not. Like, this is going to happen. You're going to end up, a cousin that you don't like is going to corner you and talk to you about how amazing your dad is. And your brain is going to be going, I don't remember you two even interacting. They're going to be fucking grief junkies showing up like the fucking grief lamprey eels, like in, especially in a Long Island Italian family. We've got a lot of like, well, I get a funeral to go to and I get to wail and cry and make a huge stink about how close I was to the deceased.
Yeah, I got 50 stories I'm going to tell and no one's going to stop me.
Yeah, and I'm like, make sure you, Tiffany, start working on the eulogy, blah, blah, blah. Like, I just, like, and I was able to, I felt like I was, this curse of my dad dying when I was young ended up being a blessing because it gave me the tools I needed to help my new in-law family process something that the similarities between how it all went was just so wildly coincidental. It was weird. It was truly fucking weird that, like, how similar the two experiences were for me.
Yeah.
Like, and being able to be like, it's something that's awful, but the second time through, you know what I mean? Like, you're playing a video game, you're like, this video game was brutal. It destroyed me. It's like, but the second time you play it, I know how to, like, at least not lose all my lives. Like, I could complete the game a little faster.
Yeah, yeah. It's that, there's that parable of, like, there's a guy in a hole and the one guy comes by, a fireman comes by and says, I can pull you out. Give me a second. I'll be back. And then another guy comes by and says, oh, you know, I can figure out a way to build a ladder down there to get you out. And then the third guy comes by who's a preacher or something. And he jumps in the hole with him. And the guy's like, what did you jump down here for? And the preacher's like, oh, I've been down here before. I know how to get out. And they, like, you know, they walk down together.
Ah, yeah. I'm tearing up. I just welled up. You telling me that story?
Well, just wait till you hear someone tell it properly, because I definitely fucked it up.
Right. I got. Wait till you, when you can see the person's face and not just a giant USB port.
You just heard the bootleg. You heard the version of that story that is the equivalent of a man holding a camcorder in the back of a movie theater selling it to you as a DVD.
Yeah, right. There are people crisscrossing in front of Dune.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
It's been many years since your dad died, right? You said like a decade, is that right, about?
It's just crossed like 10 years, yeah.
Do you feel like the way in which you think of that death has changed for you a lot?
Yeah, there's no more real negativity around my relationship with my father anymore. Like, I've processed all that. I still mine it for comedy. Like, I still like to tell people like right. jokes and stories about how fucking intense and weird my dad was. And I like, and it's clearly set me down a path. But now my brothers are all older, and one of my brothers is married with kids and the other one is in a serious relationship. And it's like, one of the things that ties us together is getting to talk about my dad in both positive and negative lights. And it's like that's something that, you know, like my dad would ruin by being present that. Like, you know what I mean? Him not being there makes me and my brothers worthy of men in the family now. I mean, I am 40,
yeah.
But you never feel that way when you're around your mom and dad. But like,
sure. But you like, it sounds like what you're saying, and I don't want to shoehorn your life into my
philosophy. Try, please, because I don't know what I'm saying.
Is that, well, it's that you like made something of the death of your dad. I feel like there's, right, I've said this before on the podcast, but it's like people say everything happens for a reason, and I don't think that's true unless you make a reason out of it, which I feel like is what you're doing. You're like, I'm using this to like take on a different role in my family, to help my wife deal with her suffering.
Yeah, and not to mention the real... I did really be hit. I got hit really hard by the life is short attitude at that point too. Like I changed my mind on, you know what I mean? Like I was just like, life's too, I tell this story way too much, but the thing that hits me, one of the things that hit me the most about my father's death was my dad was one of the smartest people I ever knew. He was an avid reader of newspapers and like the weekly important magazines, knew everything, GED educated, fucking IATSE local one union guy. But he had a bookshelf of books. People would get him books as gifts. He would buy books that he wanted to read. Mariano Rivera's autobiography was one of his.
Ooh, what a book.
Yeah. I know. My dad's that's my dad's favorite Yankee of all time is Mariano, he was saving those books to read once he retired because that's when he thought he would have time to read. And then my dad died with a bookshelf full of unread books. And
holy shit,
there's a fucking analogy there of like, read the fucking books while you're alive, kid. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Stop and smell the flowers. And it really changed my, I was actually talking about this the other day because I had like an epiphany in life where I was like, I didn't think I deserved a lot of enjoyment things until I earned specific like rewards in my head and shit like that. So it'd be like, I can't actually go on a vacation until I've earned it. I can't actually travel until I've finally booked a couple of movies that, you know, like things that still haven't happened. And I finally eventually was like, rip the Band-Aid off and do the fun shit now, because what if you die at 51, dude? Like,
yeah. What are you waiting for?
No one in my family lives that long. And I'm definitely an outlier. I moved to Los Angeles. I don't drink as much as my family does. So I might potentially outlive all these young deaths. But at the same time, just in case I don't, I'm doing the cruise this year. Like, I'm not, you know, like, you can't take it with you.
Yeah.
My dad wouldn't let my mom retire him from his job when he was on this year-long sick leave, because he believed he was going to go back to work. And if he would have been retired, my mom would have access to his pension, which in like a middle class family, the pension is what you're working for, like in a union job like that. My dad, like the pension was what my, my dad made okay money because it was a real union job, but it was, the pension was what it was worth. Like my dad would always fight, the unions will get you a pension. The pension is the way you can live your life. And then my family never got it because my dad, because my dad believed he was going to get back to work, or naively or not, and because my mom didn't have it in her to force him to do it.
Wow.
And so it's like one of those things where it's like, fuck, like you have to think about the future and the potential lack of it. Like you have to, like, can't keep punting cool life events or big decisions down the road. You got to just fucking, you got to get involved. You got to start living life.
You got to do it now.
Get busy living or get busy dying.
Yeah, stop listening to this podcast. Get out there and do it.
I came up with that.
What is that from? Is that like Shawshank or something?
That's Shawshank.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Gabrus, also, when I was on your podcast, you alluded to at the end of it, miscarriage. Is that something that we can talk about a little bit?
Yeah, we can talk about that. That's something that not a lot of people talk about, which is part of the reason why me and my wife, like why my wife is okay with me sharing this on the podcast and why she talks about it in with people all the time, is because when it happened to us, it was something that we thought was so distinct and sad to us. And then we learn that it's 1 in 4 pregnancies, and so many of our friends went through the same experience, because also our friend group features a lot of people deciding to get pregnant in their late 30s because they finally have health insurance.
Sure, yeah.
They don't get health insurance in right. improv until you're fucking writing for Colbert or whatever, you know? So like, you have to like, And there's this weird, like, no one talks about it. So when it happens, you feel particularly awful. And I can't speak at from the female perspective, from the person who the egg was inside of perspective, but it rocks you both hormonally, like physically, biologically. Having something like that really affects you, and then psychologically, it hits super hard. And I hear from women who've like who take the blame, you know, who blame themselves, who say maybe I'm not destined to do the one thing that blah blah blah, and it's like. No. Having a kid does not make you a person. It's 2021. You could be a mom or a dad or a parent in 1,000 different ways that, like, it doesn't have to be you came out of my pussy and this is the guy I'm married to at the time. We're your parents. Like, the world is different now. Like, you know, you could be 50 years old and adopt a 9-year-old. You could be raising your nephew practically. You could just be the cool aunt and uncle, which is what my wife and I decided on. And this is what's crazy is, like, we experienced a couple of pregnancy losses and still did IVF, did all of that stuff, did all the steps you do, all the expensive shit, and then came to the conclusion and not having nothing and, like, or maybe I can't say having nothing to do with having lost pregnancies, but we decided, we were like, why are we trying to, like, we had realized that, like, we were feeling some sort of external pressure to having kids. And no one was specifically giving that to us. Maybe it was like societal or whatever, or just like seeing all your friends having kids and be like, oh, it's time. And then we were like, it didn't work. And they were like, okay, this is pre-pandemic. So, like, what we said was it really destroyed. It affected me big time, but it really fucked up my wife. Like, she was having a hard go of it after that. And we were saying, okay, we're not talking about IVF or having a kid for, like, we had one good egg fertilized zygote. It's on, got it on ice or whatever. And we were like, let's not talk about pregnancy, having kids or anything between us for like a year, 6 months, 9 months. I forget what we said, but we said, let's not even think about having a kid, implantation, any of this shit. Let's not think about it at all. For like a year, let's let it get out of our brain. It dominated the last 3 years of our life. IVF, shots, going to the Kardashian's fertility doctor every week, you know, spending a fucking fortune. Luckily, we were beneficial that my wife had a insane health insurance at the time that had, like, you can get a grant to help you pay for, like,
oh, wow,
family stuff like that. So it was like, thank God it was not all out of pocket because it's insanely expensive. And, but we took that year, 6, 9 months, whatever it was, off from talking about it, thinking about it. And when we came back, we were sitting right next to each other. But when we were like, it's like as if we both went off on like weird vision quests.
Yeah, on journeys.
We both did DMT and came back and we're like, all right, now I'm ready. Now, but like we realized we were like, and I've talked about this on other pods, but I'll repeat it here. Like, I do a lot of like, fantasizing about my future. Like, that's something that I've always done in my life, whether it's because I'm doing The Secret or because I'm an escapist or whatever. I'm always imagining, like, oh, imagine, like, I picture myself like with a gray beard, like surfing in Costa Rica at like 60, you know what I mean? Like, and yeah. I would imagine all these cool things and all these amazing things with me and Tiffany, my wife. We were just like imagining all these like amazing, and in my head I started to notice that none of my fantasies were like, we're at our kid's baseball game or like we're dropping our kid off at school. It was all these things that her and I prioritize, which is like travel and life experience and freedom and sleeping. Yeah. And it was like, oh shit. So I just came home after being away for a few days for a gig, came home and I was like, I've been thinking a lot. And Tiff's like, yeah, because all we were thinking about is like, we need a house. We need to have a kid. This is what everyone's doing. We need house and a kid, house and a kid. We need to mortgage kid. And then once we were like, wait, do we really, really want this? And like, now we've officially tried, we've talked about it, we've done a lot. And then we were like, you know what? I don't think I do want, at least not right now. And I know when you're like 39 deciding to not right now have a kid, but we made that decision. It's like, we're not doing this right now. And if down the road our mind changes, like we said, there's a lot of ways to be a parent, you know. And also, we, in the last couple of years, our younger brothers started having kids. So now we're aunts and uncles.
Yeah.
And being an aunt and uncle is better. It's easier than being a parent, like, for sure. And you get a lot of the same joy. So once that hit, I was like, wait a minute.
Hang on a second. It's a cheat code.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, I get to, like, have a kid that kind of looks like me and kind of acts like me and I get to play with. And then he goes back to my brother's hotel room and wakes up at 6 a.m. and I sleep in at Montauk till 10. I smoke weed in my room and, you know, like, all these things where I'm like, okay, no, yeah. And I also should cop to friend groups. Like, everyone I knew was having kids, except a few of my best friends out here in LA are gay men couples. Like, four of, like, mine and my wife's, like, dinner party friends are four dudes, and who are, one couple is like, we're never getting married, but we're life partners. Another couple is like, I officiated their wedding, but none of them were planning on ever having kids. That was just something they never wanted. And it was like, me and my wife would always think that was weird when we were like, yeah, but you guys are such good people. You could adopt. And then it was like, once we got, and they're a little older than us as well. And once we got a little older, we were like, well, yeah, so what if our friends have four-year-olds? We have friends without kids. And then you start to see it expand a little where now that we are in, purposely, like, now that we've made the choice to not have kids, all of a sudden you're noticing, like, oh, there are a lot of people who've made that choice. You know what I mean? And then it's like,
yeah,
oh my God, we were so confused by, like, the pattern, the routine of life, that, like, breaking that was like, we've never been happier than, and we went through a pandemic, which was brutal on everyone, ourselves included, and still happier than we've been in, like, the last few years.
Well, also, like, I mean, that idea of, like, oh, everything has to be this way, seems like it happened to you twice, right? Once when you're talking about these conversations with your gay friends, but then also when you have a miscarriage and you're like, oh, well, this has never happened to anyone else before. Like,
right.
That same thing when our son died, it's like, oh, well, we are the first people in the history of the world to have this happen because no one had ever talked about it. And then once it happens to you,
right,
all of a sudden, everybody you know is like, oh, you know what? I never tell anybody, but, and you're like, oh, wait, all this happened to all of you? All this happened to, like, a third of my friends are like, oh yeah, we, you know, we tried to have kids and, you know, my wife miscarried or whatever. And that there is, like, I know I'm stealing this from.
There's an element where people don't know how to talk to you about something sad unless they've done it unless it's happened to them as well. Like, people have a hard time. Like, if you were at a dinner party and for some reason brought up that you had a child die, the way how uncomfortable other people would be, no matter how comfortable you were.
Yeah.
The way other people have a real hard time with grief. And that's something that I've always been trying to get over of, like, I will directly speak to, like, and again, going back to other stuff that I really appreciate in life, and you've known me for a little bit, I'm rather direct. I'm rather, like, say what I mean about people and stuff like that.
Yeah, a little bit.
And I will do that with, I'll be like, that is so fucking sad and so fucked up. I can't believe it. Talk to me. Like, and that's something, that's maturity that I've gained in the last few years.
Yeah, that it's like, let me ask you about that. Like, let's talk about it a little bit more. And the thing you're saying is exactly right, that, like, people don't often want to share it, not because they don't want to talk about it, but because
they don't want to make other people feel bad.
Yes, and also because they don't want to have to do the work of making you feel better after. Like, they want to be able to just have the conversation, but instead it's like, oh, I just fucking, emotionally, you feel firebombed right now. And I totally know that feeling of, like, I had gone through, like, back and forth about telling people about it, never talking about it. Then, like, sometimes when it's like, you know, I'm just going to, anybody who asks me, how many kids do you have? Well, I have three kids. One of them is dead.
Man.
And I remember being at, but I always, you know, some days I say two. It depends on what day you catch me on.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't thought about this forever. But I remember that when I interviewed at SNL, the first interview, someone asked me how many kids I had. And I was like, oh, I have three. One of them is dead. And I was like, I don't know if this was the place to bring that up, like right away.
Yeah, Lauren's like eating popcorn, like, funny. I don't know if that's a sketch idea, MCK. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, it's not a comedy pitch, I'm telling you.
Yeah, I don't see how we mine this for comedy. It was not Lauren. And whoever it was, I don't even remember. They were very lovely. But I remember being in that moment, feeling like I had to say it for whatever reason. I don't know why. But it was just like, I have to be honest about this.
It's sort of a tribute to the lost child, like clocking that they're in your life like that. I feel like that's important. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I think that really touched me. You saying that, like, I didn't know that about you. And that's like insanely touching. And now I'm tearing up. Here we go. A good cry.
The other thing I wanted to say that you made me think of is how I identify with so much is that when you guys experience that miscarriage, that you're like, that feeling of, well, this is like, it's ground zero on my wife. Like, it's happening there. Like, that's the person that it's happening to. And I'm here and I also feel it. I just know that so much. I know that feeling of like, she's got to take care of, like, right now, she takes care of the kid and I take care of her. Like, my job is making sure that she's okay. And I remember that, like, she was getting the direct impact of the emotional pain. And then it would hit me secondarily. I'm getting an aftershock. I'm getting like, oh my God, I don't know how to make my wife happy anymore. Like, I think it's over for her ever being happy again. I can't do it.
Yeah.
And that's like, I think that's like a thing that I've never heard anybody talk about. And I know that millions and millions of men have felt. And it's not to be like, my pain is worse than anybody else's. It's just a thing I didn't know about until it was happening.
Right. Well, that's part of the difficulty of lost pregnancies, which we've had multiple, is that it's so emotionally ravaging, but you don't, like, it's also physically ravaging on only one of you.
Yeah.
And it's like, my wife's we're both dealing with the equal level of emotional sadness, but then my wife's also hormonally and biologically rocked by this. So it's like, they're dealing with stuff I can't even wrap my head around. Do you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
And you're just like, oh shit, I'm here for you. But then also you're like, I'm really sad too. Like this is fuck. Like, it's such an intense dynamic to find yourself in. And then especially we had some fucking crass ass situations. Like, and I the first time, my wife was not feeling well when she was a few weeks pregnant, or, you know, like X amount of weeks pregnant. We went to the hospital. She got like a look at there, a little sonogram. And the doctor said to someone else, yeah, it looks like the pregnancy. Like, we overheard him.
Ugh.
Like, that's how we heard. There was no presentation. Like, he said it to someone else, sort of like, that just ruined us. That just ruined, like, we were like, well, fuck this. Like, it's like, if we can't get treated well in this moment by like a medical professional, it's like.
Yeah, man. So then the doctor just rounds the corner and comes in to talk to you. And you're like, we know already. What happens then?
Well, we were like, what? Like, what? We heard you. Like, and then he's like, just explains, like, yeah. And we were like, well, that's what we thought, but. It felt so weird to hear that. Like, and around the same time that we were dealing with this, some women in comedy dropped like a testimonial PSA black and white video. I think it was like June Diane Raphael, Jess St. Clair, Jean Philippique. I believe it was all of them. And they were talking about pregnancy loss and pregnancy difficulty, like, as if, like, we need to drop, like, we need people to be talking about it. Like, we want you to know it happens. You know what I mean? Like, and it doesn't mean you're weak. And it was like, that came out at like the most insane time, because some of those women I listed are friends of mine and my wife. So it was like really exhilarating for my, like truly made you feel at home, you know, like made you feel
had,
like.
Had you ever talked with them about that subject before?
No. And then like, I text Jess St. Clair after seeing that, you know, I was like, this is like, I'm trying to remember exactly who's it, or someone texted me after I told them that or something like that. It's just, it's a crazy, it's such a weird thing to deal with, because it's not 100% grief either. Like, cause that you didn't necessarily have an attachment. So like, there's like this weird, feeling where you're like, am I too sad for something? And then when you learn how common it is, and if you are like a not a life begins at conception person, you start to believe like, okay, well, it's not exactly what, it's not as big of a deal as you, it's hard, it's impossible to process. It's impossible to process. You could look at it as like, this is the most intense thing, or you could look at it as like the like something else that's, it's a lot. I'm spiraling thinking about it.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things that, like, however it is you conceptualize it is very acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That it's like, okay, I think of this. I mean, I think anyone would be well within their rights to describe that as grief, to be like, the feeling I felt from this loss for sure was grief. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
John, taking up so much of your time, I wanted to ask you just a question that I normally ask people on this pod before I let you go, which is, do you think about like where your dad is now? Like, does he exist in a place for you? Is he like part of your daily life? Or even, you know, the miscarriages too. Are you like every once in a while, it happens much less frequently, I'll like, you know, get an amazing parking space and I'll be like, oh, you know what? This is Fisher hooked this up. You know what I mean? That's my son who died. I'm like, this is it. This, like, you know what I mean?
That's so cute. That's
I almost never anymore, but like right after he died, I would do that frequently. No logical part of my mind believes that, right? I know that's wrong, but I still sometimes am overcome with the superstition of it.
I believe it, man. That makes sense. And that could actually, the way I look at something like that, and again, forgive me if this is like crass in some way, either it's real and Fisher was eyeballing parking spots for you, or it's all in your mind, but it makes you feel better. Then either way, it's a fucking win, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. I feel that way too.
Like, I believe it could actually be true, but if it's also something you're just doing to stay connected, it's just as important. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
No matter which direction it's coming from, who fucking cares? That's the thought.
Do you feel that way at all?
I'm not very religious, afterlife-y type guy, but I do have moments in my life that I know are infused, even if they're not spiritually because of my father, it's something that my father would like or something that my dad would like about me. You know, like a lot of these things that I do, and like, it's hard. And I also, I'll combine a plug in here too, like a real tacky asshole, but I have a podcast called Action Boys where me and two of my buddies break down action movies that from the 80s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And that was one of the handful of things me and my dad connected on, was watching Van Damme and Seagal. And
that's awesome.
My dad and I were both martial artists who loved action movies. And so I feel as though I quote him a lot on the podcast. And I say, because he was like a very quotable guy. He's a fucking lunatic. Who, like, you know, so like we have a lot of fun. And I quote him a lot on the podcast. And then on the anniversary of his death, like a couple of years ago, I posted a photo of him. Like, I love this photo of him in the pool. He looks so pissed that you're taking his photo. And it's like the most authentic version. I'll DM you the photo.
I think I've seen it. Did you post it on his birthday or something one year?
Yeah.
I've seen
it. He's got just like the most, my dad's name is John. John Gaber's face ever of just like, put the fucking camera away. But it's like, this is my tribute to you, Pop. There's very few pictures where you're smiling.
I love you.
But, I'll quote a bunch, and someone posted on that, wrote, "Turn it off, Johnny," which is something my dad used to say about like if you were hot or the bug bite itched or something was annoying you, he would go, "Turn it off. You have to be able to go in your mind and turn off the pain." That was like some weird karate bullshit my dad believed.
I love that. That's so hardcore.
It's so hardcore, and especially to tell your like 12-year-old son that, who just like fucking hurt himself playing PAL soccer. Shut it off, Johnny. But someone posted that, and my brother screenshots and sent it to me. He goes, "What the fuck is this?" And I go, I tell some dad stories on my podcast, and I learned in that moment that my dad's memory is alive in strangers, which is like,
yeah,
which is kind of weirdly. I'm now crying.
That's beautiful, man.
You got me, Mike. You got me right at the end during my plugs. Gary's crying through his plugs, but strangers knowing my dad, like, I feel like that's even whether good or bad, the stories I tell of him are like the fact that his memory lives on with the 5,000 fucking freak mouth breathing freaks that listen to Action Boys. Like that means something to me. And honestly, based on my dad's like narcissism and ego, I feel like it means something to him too. Like, I think he would be proud to hear that strangers believe him to be an interesting guy. Like, I think because my dad was super vain and super narcissistic. So I do think he gets a lot out of it. Like, however understanding of metaphysicality we have.
I mean, that makes so much sense to me. My wife became a pediatric intensive care nurse, right? Basically, would she have become one anyway? I don't think so. I think that's because our son died. So it's like, he lives on.
That's some powerful ass shit. That's some powerful ass shit. That's like finding your calling in.
Yeah, dude. And he lives on through that work. Like there are kids who are going to leave that hospital alive because, you know, my wife would hate me. I describe this as way over dramatizing what she does, but their kids are going to leave that hospital in better shape because my son died. And like, for me, I don't know how to do that. I know how to do this. And so, you know, inch by inch, he survives through this.
But what you're doing here on A Good Cry is the same thing. You're honoring, you're like, I went through this awful thing. I know other people have. Let's get talking about it. And I don't think your kid is going to be like, would be upset like to find out about this in whatever, however metaphysicality works.
Wouldn't that be amazing if he was though? If he's like in whatever afterlife being like, oh my God.
If he was like, you finally go to the light at the end and he's like, Dad, what the fuck with the podcast? You're like,
he's like, you did a podcast? You could have done anything and that's what you did?
Yeah. And you give me credit for parking spots? Fuck you.
Do you know how much other shit I did?
Do you know the amount of car accidents I saved you from by making you change lanes and you didn't realize? And you're fucking telling me, thanks for the parking spot?
Gavers, thanks for doing this, man. I really loved it. Dude, I really appreciate it. It's very generous of you. You're the best.
Please, you're the best. Thank you so much for having me on. This was awesome. And I think what you're doing, and something I believe in, is like, I talk about all the bad shit that happens to me because I do. It is nice to hear someone else. When everyone has had so much bad shit happen to them, if you can find kinship in someone else by saying like, oh yeah, I understand that experience. Like, that's important. I think that connects us just as much as happy stuff connects us.
I hope so. I feel, even if that's not true, I feel that it's true. I believe that. I agree with you.
Yeah, I believe that. I think shining lights on positive things and problems are the best way to like fix them. It's like, just point at it, no matter what it is. Like, if it's something joyful, point at it and relish in it. If it's something upsetting, point at it and relish in it, in the negative version of relishing.
That's good advice from John Gabrus. This was episode 7, 6. It's one of the episodes of A Good Cry. Thanks for listening. I hope it helped.
The listeners know more than you do at this point. They're at the hour mark of it. They're like, I know which episode it is, pal. You don't have to label it now.
They turned it off 40 minutes ago. Thanks, Gabrus. I think we got it. I think we're done.
Sick.
A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Bree Mateng.
That was a HeadGum podcast.